We're doing our class, Judaism head to toe. We're still up to the mouth. So let's discuss a few more halachot of eating. We have, in ancient times, the Talmud says, just as Jews were into serving Hashem, so pagans were into serving their idols. And they had this zeal that whenever they can get their hands on some wine, they would libate it in honor of the pagan gods they believed in. And they were very big into this. And if you happened in high school to read Homer's Iliad or Odyssey, you see that one of the things when they're out at sea and the waters are getting turbulent, so they start saying to themselves, why would Zeus be upset at us? I don't know if it was Zeus or some other god. They say, we were good. Just before we embarked, we offered a sacrifice, and we didn't dare touch the wine without libating in his honor. He couldn't be upset at us that we forewent that. You see how careful they were, that libating was this thing that if they would dare touch wine and not libate it in honor of the gods, they would feel like they had offended the gods. So we had this challenge, because anytime they could get their hands on our wines, they would libate them too. And the Torah says in the Parshat Ha'azinu, Yishtu Yein Nesicham, that when the Jewish people end up intermarrying and going off the way of the Torah, one of the things they do is they drink that wine that was libated in honor of pagan gods. From that verse we understand that we're not allowed to drink wine that was libated in honor of a pagan god. Now, this prohibition is biblical. So Yayin Nesech, wine that was libated in honor of any god, is prohibited, just like an animal that was sacrificed in honor of a god is prohibited. Just like we've had this big question this past two decades about whether the wigs that they buy from India that women shave their head in honor of the god, whether that's considered that they sacrifice that in honor of a god. So it's different versions of what they're actually doing up there. They come to this temple and the priests tell them that they should shave their head in honor of the gods, and they do, and then they think their hair is being sacrificed, or maybe part of it is burnt in honor of the god. The rest, the priest takes and sells to the Jewish wig makers, and this is a multi-million dollar industry. So the question is that here permissible to be used for a wig? Because any item that was offered as a sacrifice to a god is prohibited from any benefit. You can't even sell it, let alone wear it or eat it or use it. So that's the classical issue we have, what's called Yayin Nesech. Then the rabbis extended the biblical prohibition to a rabbinic one. And the rabbi said, being that we cannot trust the pagans, they're so into this libation, any time a pagan was left alone with a bottle of wine, you would not be allowed to benefit from that wine. The rabbis made a rabbinic prohibition that any time a pagan was found that he had access to Jewish wine or to any wine, you would be prohibited from having any benefit from it. So that's a rabbinic prohibition. The rabbinic prohibition is called Stam Yenam. It's not, people wrongly say, Yayin Nesech. It's not Yayin Nesech. You know, if I had, very often guys come to visit me with their parents. So the guy converted to Judaism. There's no problem. We have at our Seder many times, I honor the Gerim to pour the wine for everyone. And I tell them, you see, I trust your gear. You see, I'm willing to drink the wine you pour. You're pouring it. Technically, if I didn't know if your gear was good, I wouldn't be able to drink it. So I very often, when at our Seder, we have the converts pouring the wine. But people wrongfully think sometimes you come to a wedding and they have wines there, especially in the last 5 years it's become in Israel to make the wines not cooked, and we'll discuss what that helps in a minute. And then people say, hey, there are non-Jews here. This is so-and-so's parents. They're not Jewish. So-and-so converted. Can you drink the wine? So they wrongfully say it's Yayin Nesech. It's not Yayin Nesech. Yayin Nesech is when I know the wine was poured in honor of a pagan god. That's Yayin Nesech. What we have is Stam Yenam. We have wine that is called Stam. It's plain. I don't know what happened with that wine. And so the rabbis forbade that wine. The rabbis said, when you don't know, when a non-Jew had access to the wine, you're not allowed to drink it. So then the rabbis extended that prohibition from Stam Yenam, which was a concern because of how avid these pagans were. The rabbis extended it and said, if people drink in the bars with their non-Jewish friends, they'll end up marrying their daughters. And so the rabbi said, in order to ensure the people marry within Judaism, and don't get tempted to marry Lisa or Becky or whatever, your next door neighbor's daughter or sister. So the rabbi said, we prohibit drinking of alcohol together. We prohibit any wine, not only because of the concern that they might have libated it, but also to ensure that Jews don't end up marrying non-Jewish women. This was a historical problem from the time of the First Temple. From the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, the Jewish people were tempted to marry non-Jewish women. And you see, Shlomo HaMelech had many wives. And the Torah says they weren't exactly faithful. It says Shlomo's wife offered sacrifices to pagan gods. So Chazal say it means they didn't convert wholeheartedly.
Those kids aren't Jewish?
Good question. And then you continue having this problem throughout the period of the First Temple. And then in the Second Temple period, when Ezra ascends to Israel, he finds many of the Jews had intermarried. And so the rabbis realized that one of the reasons this was happening was because if you go to the bar together and you drink together and you end up being buddies together, so you could end up, that can very easily happen. So we discussed the prohibition of pat akum, non-Jewish bread, that the rabbi said, don't eat your next door neighbor's chocolate chip cookies or bread, because then you'll end up falling in love with his daughter, Becky, who made those chocolate chip cookies. It's only a matter of time, you and etc. You, your son, whatever. And then the rabbis also said, Gazru al yeinam mishum b'noteihim. The rabbis forbade non-Jewish wine for concern that people would end up marrying their daughters. So this is very relevant. Today it's a very in thing in companies that people are invited to the bar. A lot of deals end up being made in the bar. We're not taking questions now. It can be very relevant. Where it's also relevant today, it's relevant for you guys because some of you have not yet converted. So you have this technicality, which is if you're invited, you don't know if the wine was cooked or not, you shouldn't be the one to pour it. And I'll explain. The Talmud says that it's known, and it seems like it's known today as well, that once a wine was cooked, so then it's not considered a good wine. So that's why they stopped cooking wines. When the Golan Winery was born by some French connoisseur, so he said, I'm not cooking the wines, that's beneath my dignity. And he fought the government, and he finally got approval, and then he started this fad that I have an important wine, my wine can't be cooked. Now, he really believed it. And then the other wine companies, in keeping with him, they also don't cook their wine. It used to be that you couldn't find wine that was not cooked in Israel. And this changed about 10 years ago, slowly. Till today, at least half the wines aren't cooked. Now, the idea of mevushal, cooked, is that once the wine is cooked, I don't have to be worried. I could leave it open, there can be non-Jews in my house. I don't have to be worried, there's no biblical or rabbinic prohibition, because the whole rabbinic prohibition is based on the biblical one. The biblical one is a concern that they libated it. No self-respecting pagan would libate cooked wine. It's like, ooh, that's like syrup, you don't touch that. Right, so they wouldn't. That wouldn't be an act of respect to their gods. So we were never concerned once the wine was cooked that it was libated, and therefore the rabbis never prohibited it either. So you end up having this weird loophole where a person can say, "I'll go to the bar with my non-Jewish neighbor and drink with him and his daughter, but I'll drink mevushal wine." No, that's not what the rabbis wanted. Right? We understand the concept here. Right? That's not the idea. But it's an important leniency. Because it means, in my house, I try to ensure that all the wine is mevusha. All the wine is cooked. And that way, even if I have guests who are in the gear process, they didn't yet finish the gear process, so they're still in that stage where technically they're not yet Jewish. So they don't have to worry about it, and I don't have to worry about it, right? Because it's not the wine is cooked, and therefore they could pour it for themselves, they could pour it for me. There's no problem with that wine. We have no concern with that wine. This opens up another question, and that is that pasteurization. Most wines today are pasteurized, but the way they pasteurize it is they have to bring the wine to the boiling point, and then, in order to ensure that they don't lose from the wine, and also they claim it hurts the flavor of the wine, they have it down to a science that it just reaches the boiling point, and then they cool it down. So that way they can say, we pasteurized our wine. It reached the boiling point, and then they cool it down. So then the question is that called the wine is mevushal? Is that called the wine was cooked? So that's a big argument among the halachic authorities. We prefer not to rely on that. Our assumption is that cooked is so that you can see that some disappeared, it became a little bit more syrupy. That's what we call cooked. If it was just pasteurized, so there you run into a question. Is that called cooked or not? And there are different opinions on that. When necessary, we rely on the opinion that pasteurization equals cooking. But when not necessary, we prefer having it really cooked, and that way we've satisfied all opinions. So that's our issue with wines. With regards to Yayin Nesech, Tam Yeinam, and I'm not taking questions right now. Once we touched on that, I want to take one more topic, and that is Basar Shenitaleh Min Ha'ayin. The rabbis also found that there was a repeated risk that the pagans would switch our meats. And this is happening till today. Meaning every year we find one or two scandals where here in Israel for sure, this is known that it happened in the United States as well numerous times. It happened here in Beit HaNasi, right, in the Great Synagogue. That's the famous story, 2-3 years ago. Netanyahu had some event there and they caught that it was non-kosher meat being served. Not his fault. There was a game being played there and they were switching the meat. They were getting in cheaper meat that was not kosher and just serving it. So this has been a problem historically from the days of the Talmud where there would be danger that people would switch the meats. So in all honesty, it's not only the non-Jews, it's also Jews that have been caught switching meats. That's the famous story of the butcher in Muncie. That all the rabbis, everyone was eating his meat. It was considered the finest kashrut. And turns out they're eating non-kosher meat, so it seems. That's the indications we have. We have the same story here in the Great Synagogue. They have a hall down below. And it's supposed to be, you're paying a fortune of money to make any event there. And then they caught, I think it was Jews, as far as I understand, they were serving non-kosher meat. So historically, this has been a problem in every front. And that's why we always try to buy meat from someone we trust. And we also rely, when we have to, on the kashrut, on the officiating agency that says the food is kosher. But when the rabbi saw we were running into dangers that meats were being switched, so the rabbi said that with regards to meat, they're making a special institution. The meat has to be overseen by a Jew, or else there has to be some kind of identifying marker placed on the meat so that a non-Jew wouldn't be able to switch it without being caught. So one rabbi used to cut a special sign into his meat when he'd send it home to his wife. She'd open up the package. They'd have a non-Jew who would deliver it. She would open the jacket. Right, Rashi in the Gemara shows us a triangle, right? So she'd look for the engraving of a triangle somewhere where he'd leave her that sign. And once the guy switched the meat on them. He took the piece of meat home and gave her a different meat. And she looks for the triangle and it's not there. So that's one way. If you make a sign that's hard to replicate unless you really know what it is, where it is. And today, so that's, they used to have what was called the plumba. They used to have this plastic or metal clip that could not be reused that they would clip onto the meat. And then that was a sign that it had the seal of the kashrut agencies. And then people discovered that they could just replicate them in China. So they made something more sophisticated, holograms with ID numbers, with codes, and that way they check wherever you sell it. Wherever people sell meat, so there's a hologram with an ID number. So I once came to our local store, which is a big chain, and I saw the meats, and things didn't look right. The packaging was off, some of the packaging was open, so it had a hologram, but you couldn't tell if someone switched the meats or whatnot. So I called the kosher agency. And the kosher agency told me an interesting thing. They said, if you're buying from a big chain, if you're buying from a big store, like Rami Levi, Osherad, Supercell, Yenot Bitan, Barkol, you're buying from one of these big chains, so then, Kimat Chinam, Achi Kedai, right? If you're buying from one of these big chains, usually they're not going to play games. Where we find games where you have a small supermarket or you have a guy who sells once a week and then he's being offered different meats for a very cheap price. So he's always looking to get the cheapest price. These big chains are buying from big suppliers. Big suppliers, it's rare that they're going to play a game with anything. They don't have the time for it. They're making their profit. They're working with the system. Where do you find the problems? If I want to make an easy buck, I'll go into Gaza. I'll buy 50 kilo of meat. I'll find a way of forging the kashrut or throwing it onto the shelf in a store where they'll pay me for the kosher meat, which costs much more than the non-kosher meat. And there I've made a lot of money. So there's this temptation. So our kashrut is really to preclude all of that. Where does this come up? We had a student here once, amazing tzaddik, but he didn't finish his giur. And he was mamash a week away from finishing his giur. And then we wanted to make a barbecue. And he was a great chef. So he said, I'll make the meats. And I said, great. And then we get the meats and I said to myself, wait a second. Technically, halachically, I have a problem. Because technically he's not yet Jewish. Technically, if I give him all the meats and I walk out of the room and I go, so I have no guarantee that he didn't switch anything. If you ask me personally, do I trust him? I trust him. I have no problem. But I have the halacha tells me that there's a system and rabbinically I'm not allowed to do that. So I didn't tell him all of this. We just set up a helper who was with him, and we did it that way. I didn't want to tell him because, in all honesty, I trust him completely. I don't have a problem with him. 3 days later, he does his gear. Now he's more trustworthy than he was 3 days earlier. The halacha tells me I have halachic guidelines. It's not that something in our personal connection changed, but there's a halachic system. So within that halachic system, we have to work with that system. So again, this is relevant so long as there's a sign, so long as it's packaged, no problem. Once it's not packaged, once he's going to make the burgers on the fire, so then we have this rabbinic prohibition called basar shenitaleh min ha'ayin. There's an important rule in this, and that is that we do not suspect that someone's out to get us. Meaning, if, let's say, I leave a package in front of someone's door, and it was accessible to the non-Jewish mailman and other stuff, so if the mailman could walk off with that meat without having to replace it, and I'd have no way of knowing that he took it, I don't have to worry that he took it and put in non-kosher meat. I only have to be concerned if I'm flying on Swiss Air, okay, and they're giving out sandwiches with salami, slices of salami that are not kosher. And I brought from home a sandwich with a slice of salami that is kosher. So then maybe my neighbor looked at my salami and thought it was more delicious than his. So if I left my sandwich on my plate and I went to wash my hands and I come back to my plate and no one was watching it and I have no way of knowing if he switched his salami for mine. So he'd have to put his instead of mine because then I'd catch on, right? So it's not that he's trying to get me to eat non-kosher meat. We don't suspect that someone's trying to get us to eat non-kosher. We do suspect that if someone would be caught for taking my meat, then they might replace it with a different meat. That's the logic behind basar shenitaleh min ha'ayin. If the messenger can take home a better piece of meat and stick in a cheaper piece of meat and not get caught, so that's where I suspect it might have happened. The whole idea of basar shenitaleh min ha'ayin is when meat was not overseen by someone who cares about kashrut, I have to be concerned that if someone had something to gain, they might have taken it. That's our concern. That if someone had something to gain, they might have switched it for their own benefit. So we discussed two rules today. We discussed wine. We said the biblical prohibition is yayin nesech. If I know a non-Jew libated it, it's biblically prohibited. I'm not allowed to derive any benefit from it. I'd have to pour it down the toilet. I couldn't even use it to water my garden. That's yayin nesech, if I know it was libated in honor of a pagan god. Then we have stam yeinam, where I don't know what happened and I'm concerned that maybe something happened because the pagans were very zealous about doing this. Then we have the rabbinic prohibition, which expands it a little bit more, that says we don't want you drinking with your pagan neighbor because we don't want that type of connection because it's going to bring intermarriage. So that's the idea of the prohibition. And we said when we have yayin mevushel, when the wine is cooked, we don't have to be worried about it. We discussed two opinions about whether pasteurization equals cooking. Then we went over to basar shenitaleh min ha'ayin, that when it comes to meat, if the meat was not under supervision, so I have to have some kind of sign that cannot be replicated easily, which will show me that the meat wasn't switched. If I do not have that, and a non-Jew had access to it, I have to be concerned that maybe that meat was switched. Where does this come up? People are chozer b'tshuva. People do giyur. Sometimes they visit their parents. You buy your parents' house, and maybe you bought yourself kosher meat, kosher hot dogs, kosher salami, and you leave it in the fridge. and you leave. Well, if it's an open package, then someone could easily switch it. Why would someone do that? Because maybe your mom felt like having a piece of your hot dog, and she didn't want you to have one less hot dog, so she slipped in a different hot dog. And in her mind, I didn't do anything wrong, right? In her mind, I just want to make sure you didn't lose a hot dog. I want to be fair with you. I want to taste what yours were like. So there you have that problem. I tell guys, when you're visiting your parents, if your parents are either non-observant or not Jewish, buy everything in small packages. Buy so that whatever you open, you finish. Because you whatever leftovers you have, you run into problems. For example, let's say you bought a big sour cream. You used a little bit, you ate it for lunch, and now you come back for dinner, you want to enjoy that sour cream. That's fine. But maybe after you ate lunch, your dad, your brother, your mom decided they were also eating, and they wanted some of that sour cream on their hot dog or on something else. So they took their spoon, which had meat on it, and they stuck it into your sour cream and took it out. So now you have meat and milk mixed together. Or you might even have non-kosher meat juice in your sour cream. The correct way to go is to have closed packages, small packages, so that you finish what you use. And even though it might seem wasteful, if you didn't finish that can of tuna to throw out the rest of it, you could leave it for someone else. But you really run into problems if you're going to eat half a can of tuna and then finish off the other half later tonight. Because in family, you can't say different to your parents. What are you going to say? Don't touch my food. I'm living in your house. You can't do that. You know, you're staying by them. Hopefully you have a decent relationship with them. You can't do that. So you just have to say, I'm not going to use whatever I left open. I'll always reopen stuff. Okay, so that's in a nutshell. And maybe next time we have to discuss a little bit the usage of dishes. How do you use a pot and a pan in a non-kosher kitchen? If you bring your kosher stuff, how can you use the kitchen? Meaning if you visit your parents and you want to use their kitchen, how can you do that if their kitchen is a non-kosher kitchen? So maybe we'll have to discuss that a little bit. Okay, so that's later tonight. We'll get back to that.